Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI.
Today we're doing a deep dive into a really significant novel, one that's still studied, debated, and honestly quite a painful look back at the 20th century. Sylvia Plath's only completed novel, The Bell Jar. This isn't just a book you read. It feels more like an experience, right?
Yes.
You're inside a mind that's coming apart under, well, immense pressure.
Absolutely.
So our goal here is to explore Esther Greenwood's journey, the psychological breakdown, the identity struggles, and importantly, the novel's sharp critique of 1950s American society.
And you really can't separate the book from Sylvia Plath herself, can you? To get its impact, you need to know she was a key figure in confessional writing.
Right.
Known for this almost radical honesty, just channeling her own deep struggles into this raw, kind of stunning art.
Yeah, exactly. And the sources are very clear. The Bell Jar is a Romanesque fiction with a key. It mirrors Plath's own catastrophic breakdown during the summer of 1953 very closely. And the publication history is pretty revealing, too. It first came out in the UK, 1963, just weeks before she died, under a pseudonym, Victoria Lucas.
Which really tells you something, doesn't it? About the stigma back then. Mental illness, women's ambition. It was all very hidden.
Definitely.
What's interesting is that its real cultural impact didn't fully land until 1971. That's when it was finally published in the U.S. under her actual name.
And that timing is just so critical, isn't it?
It really is.
Because it lands right as second wave feminism is gaining momentum. Suddenly, this very personal story becomes a kind of shared text, almost a rallying cry for women feeling suffocated by those really narrow 1950s expectations.
Precisely. So the story introduces us to Esther Greenwood. She's 19, brilliant, a college student, and it's the queer, sultry summer of 1953. She's got this amazing internship in New York City.
Should be the high point.
It should be, but instead it's where this profound crisis begins.
And hovering over everything is that central metaphor, the bell jar. It's just devastatingly perfect for clinical depression, isn't it?
It really is.
This silent thing that descends traps her in this airless space. Cuts her off, warps reality, just freezes her ability to feel anything or even act.
So the story really kicks off in New York, chapters 1 to 9. Esther's at this Ladies' Day magazine internship. Supposedly glamorous, right? Free clothes, fancy lunches.
The dream job for a young woman then.
Exactly. But right from page 1, you feel this deep alienation growing in her.
Yeah, and what struck me immediately looking at the sources is that opening. Plath doesn't just start with Esther's personal anxiety. She links it straight away to the biggest public anxiety of that moment, the Rosenberg executions. That instantly tells you, okay, this isn't just internal. It's partly a reaction to this, I don't know, toxic, judgmental world outside, full of death and fear.
And that fear really hangs over the whole New York scene, even the fashion stuff. Esther feels caught, completely stuck between these two models of how to be a woman. Seems like the only options she sees.
You got Doreen on one side, cynical, kind of reckless, pushing boundaries.
Yeah. Embracing that rebellion. And then there's Betsy, the complete opposite. Wholesome, innocent, the Pollyanna cowgirl, as Plath calls her. Total conformity.
And Esther, she's just paralyzed between them. She's too smart for Betsy's conformity, too.
Yeah.
Well, too reserved, maybe, for Duane's full-on rebellion.
Exactly. And that paralysis, that inability to choose a self, that's really the first major sign things are starting to crack.
You start seeing the physical signs, too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
These symbolic moments in New York.
Definitely. Like the food poisoning incident at that fancy luncheon. It's not just bad fish. It feels symbolic, like she's being poisoned by this artificial world she's supposed to want.
And then that final, really dramatic rejection, her last night there. She goes up to the hotel room and just starts throwing her new wardrobe, all those expensive clothes they gave her, the costume, basically off the roof.
Watching them flutter down like bright birds. It's beautiful, but also really violent, you know?
Yeah.
A huge symbolic no to the identity they tried to put on her.
So that takes us from these sort of external pressures in New York back home to Massachusetts, where the internal collapse really accelerates.
Yeah, the internship ends, she goes home, and the real descent begins. The big trigger is brutal. She gets rejected from this prestigious summer writing course.
One she'd pinned all her hopes on.
Completely banked her future on it, and that single rejection just flips a switch. Her mental state deteriorates fast.
It's a total withdrawal. She can't read, can't write, can't sleep. Just this awful awareness of time passing and her own sense of failure.
Yeah, and she puts it so powerfully, that quote, The silence depressed me. It wasn't the silence of silence. It was my own silence.
God, that line just captures it. The internal barrier, how depression makes the whole world feel muted, empty.
It's devastating. And this leads her into the mental health system of the time, which was, well, pretty basic. Starts with Dr. Gordon.
Cold, patronizing.
Totally. Just can't see her as anything more than like a hysterical young woman.
It's really shocking how Plath depicts that early psychiatric care. That first electroshock therapy session, the ECT. It's improperly done. And Esther experiences it as just a violent punishment.
Yeah.
Was Plath just showing how bad it was for Esther or making a bigger point? Maybe about how society feared women's mental distress then.
Oh, I think it's absolutely a broader statement. It feels like this brutal, almost punitive reaction because she's stepping outside emotional norms. And that trauma just pushes her further towards self-destruction.
And the way she thinks about suicide, it's chillingly detached.
It is.
Like she's reviewing methods, hanging, drowning, overdose, like a scientist looking for the most efficient option. It shows how disconnected she is from basic survival instincts. Mm. It's purely intellectual, which is terrifying.
And that methodical search leads to the big attempt, the overdose, hiding in the crawl space under the house.
Seeking that darkness, that enclosure, like her internal bell jar made real.
Exactly. And that attempt, though it fails, is what finally gets her properly institutionalized.
Which, ironically, becomes the turning point towards actually getting help. She gets transferred to a private facility, a much better one, and meets Dr. Nolan.
And Dr. Nolan is the complete opposite of Dr. Gordon.
Thank goodness.
Right. She's respectful. She's honest. Crucially, she treats Esther like an intelligent person whose suffering is real, not just female hysterics.
Inside the hospital, she also runs into Joan Gilling.
Joan. Esther's dark mirror. Her doppelganger, almost. Similar backgrounds, similar struggles.
Why is Joan so important to this story?
Well, Joan's journey, and ultimately her tragic end, serves as this really stark warning for Esther. Seeing Joan kind of forces Esther to confront her own choices and ultimately strengthens her own will to live.
And recovery seems tied up with reclaiming agency, right? Especially her sexual autonomy, which was so denied to women in the 50s. You see this clearly with Buddy Willard.
Oh, Buddy. Yeah. The sort of boyfriend she is expected to marry.
Mr. Double Standard.
Totally. He expects her to be this pure virgin, the Betsy type, while he casually tells her about his own affair.
And that hypocrisy is just the final straw for Esther's belief in those old expectations. Her healing really starts when she actively pushes back against that pressure.
And a really radical moment of pushing back comes thanks to Dr. Nolan, who helps Esther get contraception.
Which back then was a huge deal.
A massive deal. It's this quiet but definitive rejection of societal control. A statement that her body, her choices, are her own.
And this seems to be when the bell jar metaphor shifts too. The ECT, done properly this time, helps. And Esther says, the bell jar isn't gone, but it's suspended a few feet above my head. I was open to the circulating air.
Yeah, it's not a magic cure. She's still vulnerable, but she's breathing again. She's connected, open.
Okay, let's unpack the big thematic critique here. The one that makes the novel still resonate so strongly. Women's limited choices in 1950s America. And that famous fig tree metaphor.
Well, the fig tree, it's such a brilliant, simple image for that paralysis of choice.
Explain it for us.
So Esther imagines her life as this fig tree, and every fig, every big, fat, purple fig represents a different possible future, a wonderful future, yeah. Like a husband and kids, a brilliant career as a poet, being a professor, an editor, all these amazing possibilities.
But she wants all of them.
Exactly. She wants every single fig. But the reality is, choosing one means all the others wither away. You lose them. And the pressure isn't just to choose, it's to choose perfectly right now.
Yeah.
And because she's terrified of making the wrong choice, losing all that potential, she just freezes.
And watches the figs die.
Watches them wrinkle and go black, and one by one they plop to the ground. Her inaction, born from wanting everything perfectly, leads to nothing, decay. The sheer number of options becomes this terrible burden.
Which links straight into her struggle with identity and authenticity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Throughout the book, she literally doesn't recognize her own reflection.
Yeah, in mirrors, windows. It's a powerful symbol of that fractured self.
So recovery isn't just about getting well from the illness. It's about rebuilding a self, painstakingly, that doesn't fit those neat boxes society gives her. Not the saint like Bessie, not the sinner like Doreen, something else, something authentic, even if it's messy.
Absolutely. And that leads to the novel's huge legacy regarding mental illness. Plath really challenged the silence of the era. She showed depression not as like a personal failing or a moral weakness,
right,
but as this complex, real condition, often made much worse, pushed to the breaking point by impossible social pressures. It shifted the conversation.
The ending gives us that note of fragile hope, but it comes right after Joan Gilling's suicide, which is incredibly bleak.
It is bleak, but Joan's death seems to solidify something in Esther. It leads to that final defiant affirmation near the end. Her victory, really.
That simple, powerful line.
I took a deep breath and listened to the old brag of my heart. I am, I am, I am.
Just that primal assertion, life, worth, not intellectual, just the body insisting on being. That's what finally shatters the bell jar for her, isn't it?
I think so. It's the hard-won choice to simply exist.
So I guess the novel teaches us that real growth sometimes means facing the absolute darkest parts of ourselves.
Yeah, and that maybe intense personal pain isn't just dysfunction. Maybe it's sometimes a valid, even necessary response to a world that's trying to suffocate you.
It makes you think, doesn't it? While those specific 1950s roles have changed, that pressure to have it all, today the perfect career, family, life, maybe that echoes Esther's fig tree dilemma. Even with seemingly more options, are you still paralyzed by the impossible idea of perfection? Something to mull over. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.